Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, we present advances in the treatment of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, hypothalamic obesity, and lung cancer. We review nutrition in critical illness and follow a diagnostic case involving a patient who had a lung transplant. The editors warn about the politicization of science. We discuss the dead donor rule in an era of voluntary euthanasia. Perspectives explore the forthcoming crisis in long-term care, reproductive medicine, and the realities of caring for loved ones at the end of life. Phase 3 trials of inhaled treprostinil for idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis by Stephen Nathan from the Inova Fairfax Hospital, Falls Church, Virginia, and co-authors. Idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, IPF, is a progressive fibrotic disorder for which there are now 3 approved therapies. However, the prognosis remains poor, and there is an ongoing need for more effective therapies. Inhaled treprostinil has been shown to have multimodal activity across fibrotic, vascular, and inflammatory pathways. In this trial, 598 patients with IPF were randomly assigned to receive inhaled treprostinil or placebo, 12 breaths 4 times daily. The primary endpoint was the change in forced vital capacity, FVC, at week 52. Treatment with inhaled treprostinil led to a smaller decline in FVC and fewer clinical worsening events than placebo over the course of 52 weeks. Inhaled treprostinil for idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis by Stephen Nathan from the Inova Fairfax Hospital, Falls Church, Virginia, and co-authors. In this second Phase 3 trial by Nathan and co-authors, 593 patients with IPF were randomly assigned to receive inhaled treprostinil or placebo, 12 breaths 4 times daily, over a period of 52 weeks. The primary endpoint was the change from baseline in the absolute forced vital capacity at week 52. Inhaled treprostinil was associated with a smaller decline in FVC and fewer clinical worsening events than placebo over a period of 52 weeks. Darren Teichman, deputy editor for the journal, writes in an editorial that idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is the most common interstitial lung disease, with an estimated global yearly incidence of approximately 6 per 100,000 and a prevalence of approximately 18 per 100,000. Patients with IPF have progressive dyspnea that is commonly accompanied by a disabling cough, impaired quality of life, and frequent exacerbations that lead to hospitalization. And the disease is deadly, with a median survival of less than 4 years. The results of the 2 trials by Nathan and co-authors, together with the recent findings of slowed FVC decline with the oral phosphodiesterase 4B inhibitor nerandomilast, are a welcome relief after a succession of failed starts and disappointments with other compounds. However, neither inhaled treprostinil nor oral nerandomilast stops, or better yet, reverses the decline in lung function, as was hoped for on the basis of earlier results. But slowing the decline in FVC is nonetheless important, because a lower FVC, or more rapid decline, portends a worse prognosis. The apparent benefit of treprostinil when added to established pirfenidone or nintedanib treatment is additional good news. We need additional trials to assess whether inhaled treprostinil and nerandomilast are beneficial together, as well as whether combining them up front with or without pirfenidone or nintedanib is better than sequential add-on therapy, and to understand the duration of benefits. And we need trials designated to help identify those patients in whom the benefits will outweigh the risks and side effects. But recent results are sufficiently exciting and encouraging to warrant new hope for patients with IPF. Setmelanotide for the treatment of acquired hypothalamic obesity by Jennifer Miller from the University of Florida, Gainesville, and co-authors. Acquired hypothalamic obesity, AHO, is characterized by accelerated and sustained weight gain in the context of broad hypothalamic impairment, after hypothalamic injury or disease, such as in cases of supracellular tumors or their surgical resection, traumatic brain injury, inflammation, or a combination of these conditions. Currently, approved treatments for AHO are lacking. In this phase 3 trial, 120 participants, 4 to 66 years of age, with AHO, were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive setmelanotide or placebo administered subcutaneously once daily for 52 weeks after a dose escalation period. Among these participants, setmelanotide led to significantly greater reductions in body mass index and hunger than placebo at 52 weeks. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, I. Sadaf Farooqi from the University of Cambridge, United Kingdom, writes that, given its effect on patients with acquired hypothalamic obesity, it is likely that setmelanotide and potentially other medications in this class will play a major role in the treatment of patients with AHO in the future. The report by Miller and co-authors underscores a point of broader relevance. Sometimes it is not possible to obtain objective data that predict whether a particular group of patients will have a response to a drug. Indeed, it would have been reasonable to predict that because of damage to the hypothalamus, setmelanotide would not be effective in patients with AHO. Had the investigators not carried out this trial, patients with a complex condition for which no other therapies exist would have been denied the opportunity to benefit from an effective drug. It is a salutary reminder to physicians, researchers, and regulators that experimental medicine studies and early phase clinical trials are sometimes the only means by which we can test hypotheses and ask critical questions about disease mechanisms to advance knowledge and transform human health. There is little doubt that the results of this trial will do exactly that for patients with the challenging condition that is acquired hypothalamic obesity. Ensartinib in resected ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer by Dongshun Yue from the Tianjin Medical University Institute and Hospital, China, and co-authors. Anaplastic lymphoma kinase, ALK, inhibitors have emerged as promising agents for patients with resectable ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer. In this phase 3 trial, 274 patients with completely resected ALK-positive stage 1B to 3B non-small cell lung cancer after adjuvant chemotherapy were randomly assigned to receive the second-generation ALK inhibitor ensartinib once daily or placebo for 24 months. The percentage of patients who were alive and disease-free at 24 months was significantly higher with ensartinib than with placebo. No new safety signals were detected. Nutrition Therapy in Critically Ill Adults, a review article by Jaishil Patel from the Medical College of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and Stephen McClave from the University of Louisville School of Medicine, Kentucky. In the acute phase of critical illness, adults have severe catabolism, inflammation, muscle loss, and gut dysfunction, all of which shape nutritional requirements. Early enteral nutrition supports gut integrity and microbiome health, but trials have shown that early short-term parenteral nutrition is a safe alternative when enteral feeding is not possible. Large trials have shown that early full-dose energy delivery offers no benefit over restrictive dosing and may increase gastrointestinal and metabolic complications, findings that support a restrictive nutrition strategy, especially in patients who have circulatory shock or are at risk for refeeding syndrome. Similarly, large trials have shown no advantage of high-dose over standard-dose protein, and suggest harm in patients with acute kidney injury. Because adverse events are common with enteral nutrition, safe nutrition delivery requires gradual advancement, strategies for prevention of refeeding syndrome, glycemic control, and avoidance of routine gastric residual volume monitoring. Patient heterogeneity underscores the need for precise, biomarker-guided, phase-specific nutrition to preserve lean muscle mass and improve recovery. A 68-year-old man with fatigue, fever, and hypoxemia, a case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Hillary Goldberg and colleagues. A 68-year-old man was evaluated 15 months after bilateral lung transplantation because of a month of worsening fatigue, fevers, chills, cough, chest tightness, and shortness of breath. After initially regaining excellent function following a difficult post-transplant recovery, he had returned to activities such as walking and golf, but he gradually became hypoxemic, developed exertional dyspnea, and struggled with persistent malaise despite antibiotic treatment. Imaging revealed new pulmonary nodules, diffuse lung infiltrates, and enlarging mediastinal lymph nodes, raising concern for infection, rejection, or malignancy. Bronchoscopy and lung biopsy showed inflammatory changes without evidence of allograft rejection. Fungal culture of bronchoalveolar lavage fluid ultimately grew Histoplasma capsulatum, establishing the diagnosis of pulmonary histoplasmosis in the setting of chronic immunosuppression after lung transplantation. He was treated with antifungal therapy and adjustment of his immunosuppressive regimen. His fatigue and breathing improved rapidly, and by 4 months after hospitalization, he was doing well and walking about a mile each day. The OMB and the Politicization of Science, an editorial by the NEJM editors. One of the great joys of working at a journal like ours is seeing the dramatic progress in patient outcomes that research can achieve over time. In the past few years, we've seen breakthroughs in cancer therapy, cures for genetic diseases, and new vaccines that prevent deadly diseases. These advances have been facilitated by the leadership, encouragement, and financial support of governments acting with the help of scientific advice. But such arrangements can go badly wrong, and such a threat now hangs over U.S. science. Currently, proposals for scientific research are submitted to various federal agencies where they undergo an initial administrative review to ensure adherence to all the rules, followed by peer review by a panel of experts in the field. These experts assess the proposal and assign it a priority score. The appropriate NIH institute determines how many grants can be funded, depending on its budget, and then, with rare exceptions, funds grants strictly by priority score. The NIH leadership and Congress can influence funding by, for example, changing broad budgets or issuing requests for applications in a given field. However, the decisions are almost entirely driven by science. The rule changes that the White House Office of Management and Budget, OMB, recently proposed to the Health and Human Services grant process would drastically change this process. The editors highlight three aspects of OMB's recently proposed rule changes as particularly striking: that decisions on research funding would be made by political appointees, that funding could be cut off midway through a grant period, and that foreign interactions would be severely limited. The OMB proposal is currently open for public comment, and we urge our readers to express their concerns. Contextualizing the dead donor rule in an era of voluntary euthanasia, A Medicine and Society by Carter Winberg from Harvard Medical School, Boston. End-of-life care and organ donation have evolved in parallel. Over time, medical, legal, and cultural shifts have repeatedly reshaped the way death is determined and the ways in which organs may be ethically procured. But organ donation practices have always been expected to adhere to the dead donor rule, DDR. Organ donation is predicated on the ethical commitment that retrieval of vital organs must not cause a person's death. The rule has evolved and is now commonly understood to entail two linked tenets. Patients must be dead before organ procurement, which has been called the death requirement, and clinicians must not cause death by means of organ retrieval, the don't kill rule. However, in the past decade, end-of-life norms have undergone another transformation. More than 200 million people in the U.S. now live in jurisdictions where some form of assisted death is permitted. The growing acceptance of voluntary euthanasia warrants another contextualization of the rule. The unique features of voluntary euthanasia and shifting social expectations open the door to death by organ donation and require re-examination and contextualization of both claims of the DDR. Although death by organ donation violates the death requirement, contextualization of the DDR does not categorically prohibit the adoption and evolution of this practice. Colliding forces, the aging of the baby boom generation and contracting nursing home supply. A perspective by Mark Unruh from Cornell University, New York, and co-authors. The U.S. is facing a long-anticipated explosion of the population of the oldest old. Meanwhile, in recent years, there has been an unexpected contraction in nursing home supply. In 2026, the oldest members of the baby boom generation started turning 80 years old, an age associated with elevated rates of disability, dementia, and needs for daily assistance. For decades, demographic projections have indicated that rapid growth in the population of people 80 years of age or older would increase pressure on long-term services and support systems. But these projections didn't anticipate that this transition would coincide with a sustained reduction in the supply of nursing home-based services. Nearly 10% of U.S. nursing homes closed between 2011 and 2021. The number of facilities has continued to decrease in recent years, but at a slower pace. In 2025, there were 14,742 nursing homes providing care to 1.24 million people in the United States, with an average occupancy rate of 84%. The population of Americans aged 80 or older is projected to increase by more than 45% over the next decade, from less than 15 million in 2026 to approximately 22 million in 2036. Given this growth, the number of nursing home beds is expected to be insufficient to accommodate demand, even if the current supply is maintained. Continued declines in nursing home supply could exacerbate gaps in access, strain hospital discharge processes, and add to family caregiving burdens, especially for people living with dementia. Preserving nursing home supply will require better measurement of staffed beds, targeted payment adjustments, workforce infrastructure policies, and incentives specific to dementia care. Caring for an aging America, the looming crisis of the long-term care workforce, a perspective by Andrew Olensky from Yale School of Public Health, New Haven, Connecticut, and David Grabowski from Harvard Medical School, Boston. These authors used U.S. Census data to compare projected demand for and supply of long-term care labor through 2040. The demand projection, which holds care intensity, defined as the ratio of workers to people 85 years of age or older, fixed at its pre-pandemic peak, indicates that the United States will require 3.4 million additional workers in this sector by 2040. Given current long-term care employment rates and projected immigration trends, however, fewer than 100,000 workers are expected to be added during this period, leading to a shortage of approximately 3.3 million workers. Even an optimistic projection, one that assumes a return to pre-pandemic employment rates and higher than expected immigration levels, suggests that the country will face a shortage of 2.9 million workers, roughly equivalent to the size of its entire current long-term care workforce. There are three broad categories of potential policy responses to this projected shortage: reducing demand by advancing innovation, and expanding supply by either boosting immigration or increasing wages to attract and retain more workers. Current federal policy is moving in the wrong direction on each front, however. Mandated state-level surveillance of assisted reproductive technology, an emerging threat in the United States. A perspective by Christopher Mautos from Arkansas Fertility and Gynecology Associates, Little Rock, and co-authors. In 2025, Arkansas became the first U.S. state to enact a Restorative Reproductive Medicine, RRM, law. RRM emphasizes treating underlying causes of infertility with methods such as fertility awareness, lifestyle changes, and endometriosis surgery, an approach promoted by the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank with a pro-life agenda. Though RRM aims to restore natural fertility, strict adherence to it can delay or limit patients' access to the full spectrum of proven interventions for infertility, such as in vitro fertilization, IVF. Although RRM captured the headlines, a less publicized yet equally consequential bill was introduced during the same session, Arkansas House Bill 1554, to create the Assisted Reproductive Technology Reporting Act. The bill, taken nearly verbatim from model legislation published by the Heritage Foundation, was halted in committee and recommended for interim study. Strikingly similar bills have been introduced in Texas and Oklahoma. Arkansas's proposed legislation asserts that assisted reproductive technology lacks oversight, outlining new guidelines for data that must be collected and reported to the state. The bill undermines established clinical definitions by introducing its own definitions of medical terms. Furthermore, language in the bill diminishes the experience of patients with infertility and casts doubt on the expertise of assisted reproductive care providers. Notably, proposals within this bill potentially lay the groundwork for future personhood-based legislation that could grant legal rights and protections to embryos created by means of IVF. For Those Left Behind, a perspective by Danielle DeCourcy from Boston Children's Hospital. 3 weeks. That's all they had from diagnosis to death. Dr. DeCourcy thought they would have more time. Her father had advanced lung cancer, they said. When hospice was mentioned, it seemed obvious. They'd bring him to their home to die. That's what most Americans say they want. And Dr. DeCourcy believed it too, that dying at home meant comfort, dignity, control. Compared with the ICU, home seemed more humane. She was wrong about what dying at home would require of them. The hospital bed arrived before they did. Morphine came by FedEx. In the ICU, Dr. DeCourcy can titrate drips and make patients comfortable within minutes. At home, she was fumbling with a tiny dropper of blue liquid, trying to guess if she was giving too much or not enough. "Stop giving me that dopey medicine," her father snapped. She wasn't his daughter anymore. She was his nurse, his case manager, his pharmacist, his hospice liaison, his advocate, his guilt-ridden and exhausted decision-maker. But amid the torment, there were flickers of grace. Dr. DeCourcy's daughters reading to him as he faded, his quiet smile at the sound of their voices. "When is this going to be over?" her father said. In hindsight, Dr. DeCourcy understands now what dying in the ICU offers: professional care, medication adjusted in real time, and most of all, space for families to simply be with their dying loved one. Hospice care at home shifts the burden. Families are left managing pain, adjusting medications, facing the horrors of delirium, incontinence, and gasping, all with minimal support. Dr. DeCourcy still believes a peaceful death at home is possible for the person dying. She is just not sure it is peaceful for the ones who are left behind. In our images in clinical medicine, a 42-year-old man with a recent stem cell transplant presented with a 2-week history of urinary frequency and weak stream. Papules were seen on the penile shaft. Urethroscopy showed papillomatous lesions on the urethral mucosa. A PCR assay of an excised penile lesion specimen was positive for human papillomavirus, HPV type 11. A diagnosis of condyloma acuminata of the urethra was made. In another image, a 71-year-old man was found to have a tapeworm in his peritoneal cavity during elective repair of a right inguinal hernia, shown in a video at nejm.org. Following PCR analysis, a diagnosis of sparganosis was made. Humans acquire sparganosis by consuming undercooked meat from infected snakes or frogs, or by drinking water containing infected crustaceans. On further history taking, the patient recalled having consumed raw snake meat during his military service 50 years earlier. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.